Okay, so in part one we understood how to do quantum field theory in curved space-time. So let's go back to our diagram and see how this applies to the Einstein-Hilbert action. So what we want to do is now we get rid of our scalar field. And we want to see what gravitational fluctuations actually do to the flow of B and lambda. So here's our ansatz. Now I have to tell you what is necessary to bring the corresponding matrix gamma 2 into a nice form. So first, you should go to a specific choice of gauge fixing. So I've been vague above here. But the choice that works best is a so-called harmonic gauge fixing. So this is the Donda gauge. It carries over to the framework that we have up here. Secondly, it's useful to don't work with the full fluctuation field H, but split off the conformal mode from it. So the H hat is a trace-free field, and the trace part is a scalar field on the spacetime. Okay, once you have done this field composition, there are constraints on the fields appearing on the right-hand side. So clearly, if you contract the two indices of your H hat field, you get zero. By definition, it's trace-free. And the trace is obtained by taking the trace of this tensor here. Finally, we use our freedom to choose a background. So we want to use a background d-dimensional sphere. This ingredient is not necessarily necessary. So with the material here in the lecture, you can set up the computations in such a way that you can keep your background arbitrary. The result is you spend about 10 to 100 times more time doing the computation, and you will recover the result on the sphere. So we check this explicitly. So background doesn't matter, except for speeding up your computation. Okay, I've specified all the ingredients. Let's go to exact, put this equation into exact, tell expand to second order, and look at the resulting Hessians that we get here. So now our Hessian is matrix valued in field space. Luckily, it's diagonal, so we have an HH component which propagates the traceless part of our metric field. There is a propagator for the conformal mode, and there's a propagator for our ghost field. Nicely, they all involve Laplacians, so this is nice if we want to use heat kernel. They involve powers of the Ricci scalar. So these are the potential terms that we abstractly had seen before. And they all come with certain coefficients. So this is nice because it tells us we can apply the general methods that we discussed in order to evaluate the trace contribution to the right-hand side. So standard heat kernel, expand in M. Evaluate the operator valued expressions as a function w as we had before, get the result. So result is here. I did all the integrals analytically. So you get explicit form of the beta functions for the dimensionless couplings. It's encoded in Newton's constant. You have very explicit expressions for everything that can be put into a computer. And on this level, we can A, search for zeros of these beta functions. So these are the fixed points that we are interested in. OK. Looking here, two solutions. So you can set G and lambda to zero. Then you recover the Gaussian fixed point as a free theory. You can check for more solutions. Then you see that this system has a second zero, namely the non-Gaussian fixed point at positive g and positive lambda. So The last one is the fixed point that we are looking for in terms of asymptotic safety. Then you can actually integrate the set of differential equations. Also, this can be done numerically. So here we have dimensionless Newton's coupling, dimensionless cosmological constant. Here is our non-trivial fixed point of the flow. Down here we have the trivial fixed point of the flow. Arrows point from UV to infrared. You see, for positive Newton's constant, the UV behavior is governed by this non-trivial fixed point, and from that we encounter a crossover to the Gaussian fixed point if we go to lower scales. Now, reading this diagram is not very intuitively, so let's restore units. So here, this is the same flow for the dimensionful cosmological constant and for the dimensionful Newton's constant. So here we have energy increasing from left to right. This is a logarithmic scale. What we see is that there are actually three regimes. So at very high energies, we have a quantum regime controlled by the fixed point. There's a crossover regime. And at low energies, we have something where our coupling constants actually freeze out. So they assume constant values. So if you look at this plot and ask, where is my general relativity? It's down here at low energy scales. Then it also turns out that you cannot continue to arbitrary low scales. So for the interesting trajectories that we have with positive cosmological constant, the flow breaks down essentially at Hubble horizon scales. So we can connect our diagram with classical general relativity. So we have this as a low energy phase from this one.
Hubble horizon scales, it's a reaction.
It's just energy scales.
Is that the average curve
CLD? No, you look at the value of K, where this line here is situated, and then you plug in, you implicitly rotate back to Lorentzian to interpret the result. So, as an order of magnitude estimate. So now is the question, how far can we get with the tricks that we had on the blackboard so far? So clever choice of backgrounds, suitable gauge fixing, field decompositions. What part of theory space becomes accessible with the methods that we introduced? So clearly, Einstein-Hilbert is accessible because that I showed to you. So here we use the background B-sphere, we can harmonic gauge. This is the example that we discussed. We can go to a background D-sphere, we can do arbitrary gauge by replacing gauge condition by a decomposition of our fluctuation fields. Now there was the question about structure functions. We can do the entire series R to any potential arbitrary power. So explicitly, this has been done to power n equals to 35, but the underlying structure is that we have a generating function for all the beta functions that appear along this line. Technically, this line becomes accessible by computing on a sphere. We combine it with the decomposition of our fluctuation fields and a specific gauge condition that makes the computation easy, and then we get a generating function for the beta functions for all the coefficients in this expansion. Now, we can also go to the right of the diagram with the methods that we introduced. So here, clearly, we have tensor structures involved. What you have to give up in this case is the background sphere, because then the wild tensor will vanish automatically, so you have to go to more general backgrounds to keep track of this. But it turns out that if you have the computation R squared plus C squared, still making clever choices about background, field decomposition, and gauge, you can get away with the techniques that we have done so far. Okay, this is the part of space that can be spent here. Now, PI has been involved in this for quite a long time, so you might see the launch that was there before the new annex was built. And there we already discussed the problem of how far can we actually go. And as an example, so what about including a term of this structure? So clearly this is of interest because this carries the information of the perturbative two-loop divergence. So can we do something like this? Well, the first step, we can write down the corresponding ansatz for the gravitational part of our action. So Einstein-Hilbert plus the two-loop counterterm. Now, try to implement the program that we discussed before. Have a look at the Hessian, and specifically the Hessian part that arises from taking two variations of this one with respect to the fluctuation field. Then you encounter the following structures, okay? You can take a variation of this C, you can take a variation of this C, you are left with one C, so this gives the first part. So you have a C, and there are contractions with four space-time derivatives. Okay, our fluctuations can also be extracted from one C, then you get a C squared with two derivatives, or the fluctuations can be extracted from the space-time volume, then you get a C-cubed term, and in total the matrix carries external indices which are contracted with our fluctuation fields. There are good news and bad news related to this expression. The good news is the expression is proportional to at least one power of C. That means it has the form of a potential m, and if we perturbatively expand our propagators, the expansion will stop at order m to the power of 3. So then you have saturated, you have all generated all the three powers of C's that you need to do the computation. So you don't have to go up to arbitrary high order, and at the same time you know that whatever the flow of this coupling constant is, it will stop at sigma cubed. This is the good news. The bad news is it contains uncontracted derivatives, and these cannot be removed by doing a proper gauge choice or doing a field redefinition. They are just there and they are owed to the tensorial structure of C. So here the standard heat kernel techniques that we had will not work. Good. So far so bad, we need to improve our toolbox. So what we like to do in order to access this class of computations is we want to be able to evaluate operator traces where an operator acts on a function of the Laplacian. Clearly, whatever our argument under the trace is, we can bring it into this form. So collect all contracted derivatives into forms of Laplacian, take all the appropriate commutators into account, and then the rest will be a single matrix valued insertion, let's call it O. Get rid of the functional form of W by again doing a Laplace transform to bring this into canonical form. Then insert a unit up here. So this is a complete set of basis elements. Then you can write this part here as the heat kernel at non-coincidence point, and you have the operator acting on this function. The heat kernel at the non-coincidence point has an expansion structure. It's slightly more complicated than the heat kernel because, okay, here you have this distance, the world functions between your two points, x and x prime, And your heat coronal coefficients also depend on two space-time points, x and x prime now. So if you set x equals to x prime, this guy will vanish and you get back the ordinary heat coronal expansion. Now, what you can do is you can write down a master formula for traces where you have these operator insertions. So on the, if you have this function h around, the d mu's will produce derivatives of the function. Then you contract this with the matrix part of your operators, you trace over internal indices, and you are able to again express this in terms of curvature quantities. The trick is to get your hands on these functions h and its derivatives. So without loss of generality, you can restrict yourself to the symmetric part of this function. Any other antisymmetric part will give a commutator, and the commutator can then be absorbed into your operator O, and then evaluate this at the coinciding point. Now, you can find all these h's in a recursive way. Let's look at the lowest order results. So h is the standard heat kernel. No derivatives. It's clear that this should be the result as we have before. But if we start taking derivatives of the quantities and equating x to x prime afterwards, you see you get an entire structure. Again, the expansion can be organized in terms of powers of curvatures. It becomes more complicated because now you have to keep track of the indices up here. And you see here the length of the expressions quickly grows. But the takeaway message is, if you are a clever programmer, you can set up a recursive algorithm that gives you these tensorial functions to any order in N and R. Okay, let's have some fun and see how we can do computations with them. So example one. Take a certain operator insertion, take the Ricci tensor, contract it with two indices, ask what is the corresponding value of the trace. So this is our operator. Clearly, if we are only interested in the scalar curvature, it suffices to know the scalar, the zero curvature part of our function h mu. This can be taken from the general formula here. So cross out the R terms because they are of higher order in the curvature. Then you are left with this part. Go to your master formula. Here, the operator with tensor structure is your R mu. The H is given up here. Substitute in, evaluate the formula. You see it's proportional to the Ricci scalar times the volume, and you get the S dependence out of it. Okay, this is fun. It's also not too hard. It fits into one slice. Let's make a second example. So what about the sigma cubed term from Gorov and Sagnotti? Clearly, it has the structure that we encountered before. So we have the insertion has three Weyl tensors, which are contracted with 10 open derivatives. Good news, we only need the part of the corresponding h function without any curvatures. The number of curvatures is already saturated by the c's that we have up here. Bad news is we need to keep track of 10 indices. Then you look at the right-hand side, you do your combinatorics, and you see that there are 945 terms contributing. This is the time where you ask your computer to do the index contractions. So in principle, master formula, substitute the corresponding form of the H tensor, get out the result. Would you be able to get this result based on the formulas that are here on the sheet? No. Because what I didn't tell you is that in order to do these contractions, you get two different contractions of the Weyl tensor. So So this contraction, in principle, in any dimensions, these two monomials are independent. And it happens by accident in four dimensions that there is a relation due to the antisymmetrization of the indices to map the two independent tensor structures onto one another. So that brings you to one particular problem if you do these combinations. So using the H tensors in a structure like this, you will get something in terms of curvature monomials. Re-expressing your result in terms of the basis elements that we had before is a highly non-trivial problem due to the Bianchi identities. So this requires very careful thinking about the basis elements and how to map your results from this algorithm precisely onto the basis. So this is a hard problem and we have no generic solution to it. But okay. In terms of technicalities, in the end of the day, this procedure gives you a number, and from this number, you get the sigma cubed term from your flow equation. Now, going deeper into the structure, you check that the Gorov-Zagnotti term cannot feed back into the Einstein-Hilbert part of the action. So the reason is that any contract trace of C vanishes. So the beta functions that we get for G and lambda are precisely the one that we have found with the previous algorithm. Secondly, we computed that, yes?
Is it the homogeneous background or is it?
No. It's
something general.
It's completely general and it's just a property that, well, whatever you do in terms of two variations, you are always left with a C. And then you can never get a scalar curvature out of the Weyl tensor. No matter what you contract in terms of indices, it can never give you a scalar curvature.
So you're saying in this flow, there is only one natural division, that one set of terms never leaks at.
Yes. There's no direct leaking back of the counter term into the lower derivative part.
And that's a general result for?
You can generalize this. So in principle, you can set up a matrix telling you which term could influence the flow of another term, and then you will see that it's not quite upper triangular, but you can only get terms up to two places below the diagonal. And everything else will be filled up with zeros. So here we see the onset of a general structure of this. And we also argued that beta sigma can only contain terms up to sigma cubed. Now, the only thing that is left is compute the C0, C1, and C2. So C3 we did. Now, to be honest, the problem was not the sigma 3 term. In terms of contractions, that was the easy one. The problem is in the sigma and sigma squared because there are countless commutators that contribute and make the structure very difficult. So here you really need a lot of computational power, and we burned a lot of electricity in order to get the combinatorics. And then, in a major step of reductionism, we turned this combinatorics in just a few numbers. So you see the result can fit easily on a slide, because essentially you contracted all the internal indices, you took all the traces, so in the end you are adding up fractions. You are adding up a lot of fractions, but in the end your result becomes simple. Then the crucial ingredient in the analysis of the result is this C3. So you see, what you want is a zero of this beta function for your fixed point. The beta function is cubic. That means as long as the C3 is non-zero, there will always be a root of this beta function. So as soon as you see C3 is non-zero, then you are guaranteed that the non-Gaussian fixed point that you have in this sector has an analog once you include this beta function. So the fixed point that we have seen before extends to this computation. And we also checked by numerically constructing the flow diagram that you can connect this new generalized fixed point to the infrared regime that we have down here. So also the connection between the quantum phase and the classical phase remains intact. So one comment to be added, because this is a very important development in the field. So there were a lot of people, also people in the room here, which were involved in setting up a different set of computation schemes. So instead of expanding the gamma in terms of background curvatures, you expand them in terms of fluctuation fields. So this G bar is typically taken to be flat Euclidean space, and you extract the information of your computation from the power of H's that are sitting here and the corresponding tensor structures contracting the indices about the H's. So it's clear that for curvature up to 4 derivatives, the two things should be analogous. You can map the results from one frame to another. The price that you have to pay is you have to evaluate diagrams in flat space, keeping track of external lags. So here you see, if you are interested in the flow of a scalar curvature, you need one power of h, and the number of diagrams that go into this one quickly escalates. Probably there are people in the room who have estimated how many diagrams it needs to keep track of 4 powers of h on the left-hand side. But this is, once you use massive use of computer algebra, these computations become doable, and you can extract the flow of coupling constants also from this expansion scheme. Questions so far? Good. Yes?
Is it possible to study the same similar fixed point if you don't have the terms which don't depend on wild curvature but some combinations of Riemann curvature as corrections for incidental protection?
Yes.
And the computations are similar there, or more involved?
Let's go back to the chart. So, up to this level, in 4 dimensions, up to topological terms, we understood everything. And going into this layer, it's technically complex. Okay, we discussed vertex expansions. Quick, 2 slides on what we can learn about the structure of space-time. So in the end, what we want to compute are expectation values of observables. Now, what we can do with the framework is we can derive a small sister of the flow equations that we have studied before. So we can take an operator that we are interested in, and we can compute the anomalous scaling dimension of this operator from evaluating a flow equation that is of the same form that we had before. So as an input, we have solutions of the parent flow equations that tells us how the gamma 2 depends on the scale k. And by evaluating this additional loop integral, we can then draw conclusions about the scaling dimensions of operators obtained in this framework. So what are good targets that we could compute? So essentially, we can look at an infinite set of diffeomorphism invariant operators just built up of powers of the scalar curvature. No restrictions, you can come up with more invariants, but this seems to be the easiest set. And to keep the computation simple, you can take the gamma information about the flow of the Einstein-Hilbert truncation. And here is the preliminary result that we obtained so far. So the blue line is n equals to zero. So this is the anomalous dimension of volumes. The purple line is the anomalous dimension of the scalar curvature to the power of one. So you see again the transition from energy scale is here, high energies to the right. In the quantum phase, we get anomalous dimensions. Once we affect the crossover to the classical phase around the Planck scale, all these anomalous dimensions of the operators drop to zero, and you are recovering a classical space-time picture. So we see that from here, we would conclude that our geometry also undergoes a transition from a quantum regime to a classical regime. Time for summary and outlook. So this was more a behind-the-scene talk. So I hope what I have achieved is give you some ideas about the machinery that is actually used in the field of asymptotic safety. I didn't talk much about the results, so let's fill this gap here in the summary. So we have this machinery. What we learned from this in a very coarse-grained way is that we can see the non-Gaussian fixed point necessary for asymptotic safety in a wide range of approximations. What I hope I've convinced you about is that the constructions of beta functions is a tedious procedure, but what we have done, or what we have achieved, we have reduced this tedious procedure to a well-defined combinatorical problem. So at this stage, I'm pretty sure that having good programming and combinatorial skills can lead to significant progress on this frontier. Now there are also results relating gravity metasystems rolling in. So this is mainly driven by people here in the audience, who also presented posters downstairs. And the takeaway message is that the asymptotic safety mechanism is also operative once we have adding meta to the game. That doesn't imply that we are ending up in the same universality class. Most likely we don't. But there are also universality classes that appear in these generalized gravity metasystems. Most importantly, if we use the meta content of the standard model, there seems to be a fixed point compatible with this framework. Then, in terms of outlook, well, there is definitely some more exploration that can be done at this point. So, in the last two slides, I set the onset of developing a space-time picture associated with the fixed point that we have. Definitely, there are many correlation functions that we can compute now, at least approximately. And there's the frontier of connecting to realistic theories by including meta in the game and studying particle physics associated with asymptotic safety and cosmological model building. Now, computational power is needed, but as a word of warning, just computational power will not do the job. So it will not relieve us from the burden of formulating good questions that can actually be put onto the computer. Okay, this is the end of my slide. And since I'm the last speaker, I want to take the opportunity to thank our two organizers for hosting this great workshop.
but you don't want to take any questions?
Well, if I have to decide between questions and lunchtime, I go for the questions.
Because otherwise, there are other questions.
Everybody happy?
After these wise last words, you know, no one wants to say anything.
Okay. Thank you for thanking the organizers. So for us, it was actually a big experiment in organizing the summer school, because for me it was my first one. It went extremely well, completely above all expectations I had. And that's, I think, two reasons. One, what we had single speakers for the lectures and for the tutorials. The tutorials, I think, all the lectures and the people which had the tutorials did take extremely care of having stupid and good and interesting tutorials. And for some participants, maybe it was the first time that they did a like a computation or even did a bit of programming, and so that was extremely good engaged with that. And the other thing is, you know, all the participants, or I mean, many of you really were engaged, and it was, you know, way above the typical workshop where I see people watching tennis or football. Or and also really tried and taking participating in the tutorials. And so what we told you in the beginning, you have to learn something. So I trust that you learned something. And we'll not take any quizzes. So thank you all for coming and participating and being interested and being open. And again, as I said, please fill out these surveys or send comments, because it can be helpful in helping us, you know, doing something like that again or whatever. So thank you. And again, if there's any suggestions, you know, what to improve or whether to do that again, or meet next year and discuss how to calculate let us know. Thank you.